Okay, first, can you all hear me? There's some chairs up here at the front. I feel separated by a great chasm by from some of you people at the far back. Can you hear me? Okay, all right. So at the top of my notes, it says, "Cateris paribus boilerplate," to begin with. The first thing I want to say is that this isn't what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about critical papers, the critical work that you do through the program here, but this isn't program policy. This isn't anything that the program itself demands, nor is it the sort of thing that is expected of you by other teachers. We all have our way of teaching, right? And neither one is better or worse than the other. I'm just, for the sake of argument, because I spend a lot of time with my own particular students teaching critical writing and reading, I just decided that I'd sort of share that. God, I hate that word, share. But I just used it. I'm going to share the teaching that I do with you guys here. One of the things that I come up against with students is a certain resistance to doing critical writing, and they make quite a distinction between critical writing and their creative work, and I think at some level that's valuable, and you should of course put a priority on your creative work, but they tend to make too much of a distinction there. I've never met an uncreative piece of writing. You know, the critical writing, in my mind, is just as creative as anything else. And of course, as you know, I write creatively literary and critical essays and publish them in books. So, you know, that means, to my mind, that the critical writing is very important and it's worth practicing, and worth practicing well, just as writing, okay? And as a matter of fact, some of you will, or have, maybe even already have, I don't know who's here, will be able to publish your critical thesis or your lecture. You know, there are markets for this. Not many, but the AWP Chronicle, we have a lot of graduates published there. And so this is not in any sense a waste of your time to sit there and spend some time on these critical papers. I've grown up with the idea that people aren't practitioners of a single genre, that I'm not just a novelist or I'm not just a short story writer. I view myself as a man of letters, and you should view yourselves as a man or a woman of letters, or whatever combination of those two you want to be. That means that you can turn your hand to anything. I mean, once you understand how form and structure work, then you know that any new task in terms of writing is just a matter of learning a new form and figuring out how to do it and doing it. So you should be able to write book reviews, you should be able to write critical essays, analytical essays, you should be able to write magazine articles, you should be able to do journalism, you should be able to write novels, you should be able to write poems. And I also don't mean to make a distinction between fiction and poetry and creative nonfiction as well. I mean, it's all the same thing. And anyway, so I find that people who resist these critical papers are actually getting in their own way in lots and lots of ways. The purpose of the critical papers, it seems to me, is on one level to learn a technique, to learn a structure for yourself from your reading that you can apply to your own work, okay? It's not a place for you to interpret somebody. It's not a place for you to talk about your process. I mean, I've seen all the dodges, by the way. And I know when people don't want to write a critical paper, they come up and say, well, you know, I'm going to lecture on process, and I'm on my process. And I'm sort of sitting there, well, you know, if you were Alice Munro and wanted to talk about your process, maybe that would be valuable. Meantime, what's going to be valuable to you? Talking about your own navel, or talking about an Alice Munro short story, or Scott Russell Saunders essay, and learning a technique that you can apply in your own writing, Okay, so one thing you want to do with this is learn learn something that you can apply. To me, the deeper lesson after that, and this is what I always tell my students is what I want, is that I want, when they're done with me, to be able to go out and teach themselves from now on, that they don't need me or any other teacher. Okay, that's the crucial thing, right? I went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, which was more or less a dismal experience. And I sort of accidentally had one good teacher. And I had one 20-minute session with him. Everything since that has been, I'm being facetious there, because I actually took a class with him on forms of fiction, and we read a novel a week, all right? And he talked about the structure and the techniques in that novel. I wrote about him a little bit in an essay of mine called The Novel is a Poem, because he walked into class one day, the first day of classes, and there's a long row of blackboards here, and he started at one end, and he wrote right across the blackboard, "Remember to tell them the novel is a poem." Okay, I love that. Anyway, everything I've taught myself and everything I've learned and everything that I teach people here has come out of that class and out of that little 20-minute session I had with him, because he taught me how to teach myself. He didn't teach me much in practice. You know, he taught me three little techniques. Okay, but suddenly I understood, you can actually go and find it. You know, there's a thing, and you can plunk it down in your work and make it flow and work for you, you know. So the essay or the story or the novel or the memoir is a little machine of techniques, right? Okay. So you want to end up being able to teach yourself. There's sort of some theory behind this. After I studied with that guy and was starting to teach myself things, I stumbled upon great Russian writer Viktor Shklovsky, Shklovsky, and he was one of the founders of a school of criticism called Russian Formalism. This is in St. Petersburg and Leningrad in the around the time of the First World War and the Russian Revolution. And he has a sort of founding essay called Art as Device, which is in his book Theory of Prose, which you can all find now. It's all a lot of this has been translated into English and published actually by my American publisher, Dahlke Archive. Art as Device, what they say is that it's that you take content, you take reality. What literary writing is, or what any art is you take content, which might be reality or a thought, whatever, and you make it strange. You make it surprising by making it not what you expected, not what the reader expected. The way you make it strange is by filtering it through literary devices. It's not, he's commonly misunderstood as saying you present something very odd to the reader, like you make some sort of shocking situation or insane characters or something. Well, that's a kind of low level making things strange. All he really means is you run it through literary devices, and then his critical take or his compositional take then is to go through literature and look for devices. Okay, and that's what a lot of his essays in that book are. He has an essay on composition. His essay on composition goes back and looks at early Russian folktales written as verse, and he starts to find repetitive techniques, techniques of delay, he calls them. And he pulls them out of these little Russian rhymes. And, you know, I give that to people and I say, read that. I had one student say, well, what use is this to me? I'm not Russian folk, writing Russian folk rhymes. And then I made her go and read a Raymond Carver story with that essay. And she found Raymond Carver using at least a half dozen of those techniques from the Russian folktale over and over and over again. Which isn't to say that he knew Russian folk literature, that's not what I'm saying. But a lot of the structures that we use actually are remnants of the great oral cultures, right? A lot of the structures. I mean, where does short story structure, where do these structures, where does narrative structure come from? Well, it comes from the thousands of years of storytelling that happened before we actually started writing things. And so writing is just, we're in the shadow of that great oral culture, which we actually don't know except as we vaguely remember it. So it helps become conscious of these things anyway. So Viktor Shklovsky has one of the devices that he uses in his own writing is called, so you can up this. He calls his one device that he uses bearing the device, you know, showing the device. So he'll tell you what device he's going to use in his, like in his novels, right? He'll tell you what device he's going to use, then he uses it, right? It's very pretty and kind of slightly comic device. So then the final thing, but the introductory thing that I wanted to say about this is that you should all at this stage be starting to, I mean, advise, why I say it, you should all, right? You know, it sounds like I'm giving an order and you'll be very bad if you don't do this. I don't mean it that way. You can do whatever the hell you want. And with my blessing. But I found it very helpful at a certain point, and many of my students have, to start keeping a technical notebook. Okay, this is not like a journal, it's not like a diary, and it's not an idea book either, okay? It's a technical notebook, you know? You start, if you find a technique, if you find something, you can give it a name, you can give it your own damn name, right? There's not, a lot of these things have names, but some of them don't, and besides that, you know, I call things butt constructions and globs, and I made up the names myself, because you need to own it, right, to make it work for you. You need to understand it on your own terms. So you find a technique, you give it a definition, and you write out your examples. And make notebooks. I really have kind of stopped doing this, but that's because I got old and tired. But I had four big binders full of technical notes. They're still in my study at home, right? And every once in a while, I still leaf through looking for something. Well, man, I'm a little bored. I'm going to find one that I'd forgotten and try it again, you know? All right, so start keeping technical notebooks. Things that you can teach yourself how to do and then put them into practice. The crucial thing about good critical writing, and now right there I want to stop and stop saying critical, although maybe I'll keep saying it, but it's a misnomer. It's really not a helpful word here because we have literary criticism and critical writing at the academic level, and that's often very beautiful. I have a lot of respect for academic critics. I've sometimes had brilliant readings of my own work done by academics. I love what they do, but they are actually doing something different from what you're trying to do here. Okay, they're finding a lot of thematic interpretation. They're looking for meaning. They're looking for your relationship to other writers, and so on and so forth. That's very useful in its place, but it's not what you're doing here. I lost my train of thought. What you want to do is learn to read as a writer. So okay. So what I've given you in the handout is what I give to all my students. Four pages, not all, the first two pages is what I give to all my students. If you didn't get it, all these things, these outlines and things like that, I put them up on NumeroSync. Do you all know NumeroSync? There's a writer's resource section page, right? And now I've put in a link to something called Critical Papers. I'm collecting a lot of quotations from my old letters to students and stuff like that there, and these outlines are there. And you can read through that. You're welcome to read through that. And it's a work in progress. I'm going to keep adding stuff, right? Okay, the first thing you have to do is you have to read right. And what I find is so many people just don't even know how to approach a text as a work of art. They approach it as something available to them as an intelligent reader or as an academic critic, something they want to interpret, or they want to discuss the psychology of the characters, and so on and so forth. That's generally not the right way to go. And if you write that for me, it generally means that I'm just crossing out pages of your essay, and people will get their whole essays crossed out with me. You want to start by looking at this, so I'll just go through the first page, the reading rubric. And this is just, it's incredibly simplistic, and I think people feel almost insulted sometimes when I say, you know, just stop and count the number of pages of the stupid story, please. That's important, you know? It's got to do with pacing, it's got to do with structure, it's got to do with, you know, the story, the novel, the essay, it's framed by silence. And what is there? What is what is the box? How does the box look? Is it broken up into parts? Are there subheads? Are there chapter numbers? You know, how does that work? Are there blocks of italics? Are there asterisks? What has the author done to shape the text before you even read the text? This is important. I count the number of line breaks in a story. You know, I put the number of chapters that the... I have a running thing at the beginning of each novel that I read, and I do... I say the number of chapters, and then I start doing chapter summaries. This is all on the front page of the novel. It's chapter one, pardon. You just keep track of that stuff. How long is it? Okay, how's it broken up? Okay, then you start to read, and what you want to do, again, just very simple. What is the point of view structure? This works in both nonfiction and fiction, right? Okay, and this is before you start writing your critical paper, right? This is foundational. Okay, you have to do this before you can start write an analytic paper. Point of view structure in fiction, you know, it's not enough just to say first, second, or third, right? Okay, you want to go farther than that. In nonfiction, if it's a memoir, it's obviously going to be first person, right? Well, sometimes it's not, but sometimes there's a you in there or something. But you know, then you want to notice that. But even within a first person nonfiction piece of writing, there's always going to be some sort of split between the now and the then, the now writing, the then. You want to become aware of that and actually see how it's working in the text. You want to be able to note, this is the scene of the writing, and this is where I'm in the mind of myself when I was 1.5. In fiction, you want to be able to say third person in this character's mind, or third person multiple, this character, name them. You also want to have a sense of the play, because point of view is not monolithic, it is often very elastic. And you're not reading the writer correctly if you don't become aware of the way the point of view will move up, out, to be somewhat objective, and then move deep in, okay, and back and forth in various ranges of that. You stop and think about that as you're reading through. Get that straight. And then make notes about it. Here's a big thing, and it just keeps coming up over and over again in my demand. For in critical essays is summarize, do a synopsis of the text, okay? And a synopsis shouldn't be any more than a slightly lengthy paragraph, even for a novel, okay? And this is an incredibly useful practice, and it builds through everything. But for example, when people write book reviews for Numero 5 now, I make them do it, you know? You have your introduction, and then you tell me the story. Tell what the thing looks like. Make it interesting. You know, tell it the way it give it its best reading at some level. So tell me the story of the story. Also in that synopsis, you're going to include rough number of words and that sense of how it's divided up. You know, what is the physical thing like that? What is the synopsis? When people do the critical thesis for me, again, I ask them to do that for every work that they use, that they draw examples from, okay? One of the effects of this is it situates you, the writer of the analytic paper, in the text itself. And then when you start talking about your examples, and this is really crucial, when you start drawing examples from that text, you can say where they're from, because where they're from in the text has something to do with how they're used, okay? It's absolutely crucial when you come to do a lecture here, by the way, to do that synopsis. Because I can come up here and start talking to you about a short story by some obscure writer that you may not even have heard of, and you've let alone having read the story, and you certainly haven't read the story 5 times the way I have in the last month when I come up and lecture to you. You won't know what I'm talking about if I start saying, well, at this point, Sylvia says, you have no fucking idea what I'm talking about, and you lose the reader. So and that happens up here a lot. You know, I've gone to student lectures where I can't follow what's going on, and I know that the audience is, well, half listening but probably lost and not really getting the point. So when somebody works with me, I really ask them to do a really nice synopsis before they start discussing their examples so that the audience can be situated. So again, this has something to do with the effect is good for you, but the effect in an oral presentation is very good for the audience as well. And equally in a published situation, when you're writing a book review or an essay, you're writing for people who may not have read, well, if it's a book review, they haven't read the book, unless it's the author who's reading your review. And then, or if you're writing an essay, the person who's reading it may not have read the book. And if you clarified what the book is, or the story or the essay, you've helped a lot. So this is a really good practice to do every time you're really going to analyze a piece of writing, summarize it. The next thing is just to keep careful track of words, ideas, images, grammatical structures that repeat. And then I said, but do not draw any conclusions about why they repeat yet. Okay, don't interpret. Don't jump to, I've got this student this semester, Cynthia Sample, who's a post-grad student. And I was talking to her on the phone about this, and she said, quotation, not connotation. And I thought, that's it. Quotation, not connotation. Okay, I don't care about the connotation. Quote the text. So keep track of things that repeat. Why repeat? Because repetition is the heart of art. It's the key to almost all structures. And so the first techniques you're going to notice are the ones that involve repetition. So you just start noticing that right away. Track, note, number of the instances of important repeated elements. This, in a novel, that could be plot and subplot. Subplot is an important repeated structure in a novel. This applies equally to CNF and memoir writing, obviously, because recursive and repetitive structures are often used or prioritized over any kind of plot element to organize the essay, right? So you want to be careful of that. Fifth thing to notice is time. This, again, all preliminary reading stuff. Time flow. Over and over in workshop, I will ask, what is the time flow of this story? And people have to stand back and think about it, because they haven't actually thought about it yet, even though they've read this other piece of student writing several times, right? The time flow is a rough and ready thing, but there's a chronology to any story. And sometimes, like in a meditative essay or a lyric essay of some sort, the time flow may not be, there's not going to be a narrative arc, right? There is in memoir, so this works very well there, but in any case, even in a lyric essay or a meditative essay, there will be, absolutely will be a time structure of some sort that you want to become aware of, a back in and forthing, this and that. Start to be aware of that. But in a story or a novel or a memoir, what is the overall chronology? That's one element of the time flow. And what and how is the chronology deployed in the text? That's the most important aspect of time flow. That is, here's my forward on ongoing action. Where's the backfill? How is it deployed? How much of it is there? And there are multiple techniques for deploying backfill. And if you don't start becoming aware of it in the text right at the beginning, then you're not going to learn the techniques yourselves consciously. Okay? For example, there's a story I teach often, very often. I teach obsessively this story. The Point by Charles D'Ambrosio Jr. It's very interesting because on one level, the backfill structure is very conventional. He tells you the situation. The 14-year-old boy has to take a drunk woman home down the beach from a party. And his father has been to Vietnam and come back and killed himself. We know all that in the first couple of paragraphs. So we sort of know everything that's important. The story goes on. We get to the end of the plot. He gets Mrs. Gurney home. And then he goes home. Then he gets up and he goes out. And he reads his father's last letter, and he remembers his father's suicide. The actual plot of the story ends when he gets Mrs. Gurney home. Everything after that, after he goes out and starts thinking again, is backfill. So this story has a huge chunk of backfill at the end after the plot climax. It's really important to notice this, because it's unconventional. It's a brilliant invention. that he's done, all right? He's already told you the backfill, but then all of a sudden he gives you all the detail. He gives you the story. He hasn't hidden it from you, which is a common student, you know, thing. I won't tell you my father committed suicide until the last line of the story. Then you'll know why I was upset with my girlfriend that day. How many times have I read that story? So start to notice. Okay, you notice the time flow. So, okay. Then if you're doing fiction, you want to talk about, how am I doing for, I'm faster. Plot structure, you know, I have a whole theory about plot structure, which is in that book, Attack of the Copula Spiders, that plot is a desire and a resistance pattern that repeats through the story or the novel, and it's the same desire and resistance, so you can read that and get that theory there. But what I mean by, for reading, you, again, you want to sort of look at the text and say, who's the main character and what's his or her desire, need, want, and what's the main thing resisting it? Okay? And then block that out. You know, what are the steps along the way towards the end? Just get that in your heads. Write it down. It only takes like two lines to get it really straight. And then I say, then number seven is get a sense of the basic steps of that plot. And then the last one is make comparisons. And this is often, this again is something that people tend not to do. There's a not enough comparison and contrast in your minds at just the basic level of reading. What am I reading? What rough sort of thing is this? Is it a love story? Is it an ironic culture criticism? Is it that? Just give it a name. You don't have to be right, right? You're talking to yourself, but you're trying to make. And what's it sort of like? Where have I read something like this before? You know, it's sort of like that, or it's sort of like that, or it's, you know, structurally related to this. Just start making comparisons and judgments. The second page of that handout is what I call a cheat sheet for structural questions, which really just, usually there's more space for you to fill in. So you can actually make up your own cheat sheet, and then it takes about two pages, really. And you can answer basically all those questions on your cheat sheet. So that makes it even easier for you to read, right? Okay.